From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Every war has its great novels and its signature writers. World War II, Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut. Vietnam, Tim O'Brien and Michael Herr. But who will write the literature of the roadside bomb and the desert convoy, of Guantanamo Bay and the Arab Spring? In this hour, a new generation of novelists tackles a new set of wars, from Iraq and Afghanistan to the detention cells at Guantanamo and the occupied territories of Israel.
I wanted to hold up a mirror to the insanity of this prison and try and ignite a feeling of compassion.
The main issue of this book is, what does it mean to be a human being in such a conflict? How it changes you, how it narrows you.
We should understand what we're doing when we're a part of a country that's in a war. We all bear some responsibility.
Ellen Benedict was one of the first journalists to notice that American women serving in Iraq were fighting a war on two fronts. In the field, they faced enemy combatants. But back on base, they coped with pervasive sexual harassment and assault from their fellow American soldiers. Benedict spent 3 years interviewing women veterans of the Iraq War. Her first book was a nonfiction account called The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women in Iraq. Now she's returned to the same subject in a novel called Sand Queen. Anne Strangehamps asked what the term means.
Well, Sand Queen is unfortunately a very derogatory term for a female soldier that's been in use among the troops in Iraq. It sounds sort of nice, and the first time I heard it, I thought, that's a catchy phrase. But it actually is a term for an unattractive woman who gets a lot of attention from the men because there are so few women deployed. And it goes to her head, and then she starts acting like a queen and then allows herself to be used by the men. So it's a very nasty term.
Yeah, this is an epithet that captures so much about the experience of women soldiers in the Iraq War. You spent 3 years interviewing women who served there, and you were one of the first to write about the way those women on the ground in Iraq were treated by their fellow male soldiers. How did you begin to hear some of their stories? What were you asking them?
Well, actually, they volunteered the stories. I started off these interviews because I was curious about why a woman would enlist in the military, especially when a war was going on. Some of these stories started coming up immediately. It's almost the first thing some of the women said, that their whole experience was coloured by the way they were disrespected and, if not actually, abused by the men they were serving with, who they had hoped to trust.
Were there times when there were other, perhaps even deeper stories or experiences that women had that were harder for them to tell you about?
Yes. I think the hardest thing for any soldier to talk about is their feelings of remorse when they come home. Not necessarily because of things they did that they were commanded to do, you know, dropping bombs or shooting at snipers or you know, returning fire, but because of little everyday cruelties that weren't really necessary that they would enact against both the so-called enemy and sometimes against their own soldiers, including the ones they saw as weak. And that's what I really wanted to get to with fiction, with Sand Queen, because I felt that that there was more than they were telling me. I could see it in their eyes and their gestures and hear it in their silences, or when their eyes filled with tears or when they started to joke out of the blue. I felt, oh, there's something more. There's a story underneath here they can't bring out for one reason or another. And it would be cruel to them to force it out. But I can imagine only too well what it is between all the stories I have heard and the reading I've done. And that's where fiction steps in.
Settling onto my chair, I lay my M16 across my knees and stare at the corral of sand between the tents and the wire. I know each grain of that sand by now, each pathetic tuft of dried shrub, each spot of rust on the wire's razor blades. Our little world. A second later, two of the prisoners start a furious argument. One punches another in the jaw, and in a flash, the whole damn pack of them erupts into a full-scale brawl. They're out of control now. Noses bleeding, guys rolling on the ground, punching and clawing, kicking in ribs, stamping on hands. I don't know what to do except stand up here waving my arms. So I flick the safety off my weapon and fire.
What does it really feel like deep down in your secretmost part, in your soul, to be a soldier and to see and do the things you have to do in war? What's it feel deep inside, and especially for a woman soldier? We've had almost no stories from the point of view of women soldiers about war ever in history, and it's always been a male purview. We've had stories from female civilians, but not women soldiers.
Well, can you tell us something about your two characters? Let's start with Kate. How does she come into the war, and what happens to her there?
Kate Brady, at the beginning of the book, she's a 19-year-old who comes from upstate New York. She's a country girl, and a lot of people she knows join the military because there are very few jobs out there, but there's also a very strong national pride in that area, and she enlists. But this is before 9/11, so she's a reservist military policewoman, and she has no idea she's going to be sent to war, nor at that point does anybody else. And then, like so many reservists and National Guards people, she gets deployed after 9/11 and in 2003 when we invaded Iraq.
One of the things you describe, once Kate gets to Iraq and she's stationed on an army base, she's dropped into an atmosphere in which there is a kind of constant low-level sexual harassment. Is that pretty much realistic as far as you can tell?
Right. I read studies that said that 90% of women in the military were report sexual harassment while they were serving. It's hugely common. And it can be on the level of constant vulgar jokes, remarks about your body, you know, half-joking passes made at you all the time, looking you up and down, stripping you with their eyes, that kind of thing. Or it can be worse, more aggressive and nasty and just the constant sort of degradation that happens when people refer to you as nothing but a sex object day after day, night after night, month after month.
What happens to Kate, your character?
Well, Kate has several different things going on at once. She's got a sergeant who is very hostile to her and expressing it in sexual terms, and he's got a little kind of cohort of men who do whatever he does, so they join in. And then on top of it, or she's guarding the prison, and the prisoners are furious at being imprisoned, and they taunt her and mock her and expose themselves to her. This is something that I went on a lot at Camp Buka. I heard it from many people, and there was even a television report about it. And so she's getting this harassment from all sides all the time, and it begins to eat away at her and change her personality. And she struggles more and more to try and keep a moral center in the midst of all this nastiness.
Something hits me on the cheek so hard it spins me halfway around on my feet. I drop to my hands and knees, stunned. Am I shot? I touch my cheek. Blood. But before I have time to react, a hail of stones comes flying at me, pelting me hard all over, banging off my helmet like bullets. Where the hell are the other MPs when I need them? Where's my team? I lift myself to my knees, the stones still coming at me, close my eyes, and fire again. But this time, I don't aim into the air. I aim right at the compound. Silence. Not even the echo of my shot, since there's nothing for it to echo against. No sound but the ringing of it in my own ears. No more stones. Nothing. Please, God, don't let me have hit anyone. I don't want a body on my conscience. I don't want to get into trouble. Please.
Now, in the meantime, there's the story of another woman, an Iraqi medical student. Tell us about her.
Yes, Naima Jassim is the daughter of a professor of engineering and a doctor, and they're part of the upper class there, well-educated, secular. She and her family are driven out of Baghdad by the looting and the bombing, and they go down south, right near the prison where Kate is. And then one night, the American soldiers burst in and arrest her father and her little 13-year-old brother with no explanation and take them off. So Naima starts walking the 4 kilometers to the prison every day to try and find out if they're there and if they're all right. And that's where she and Kate meet, and they end up, as the novel goes on, having a very profound and long-lasting effect on each other's lives that neither of them can foresee.
I'm getting freaked. No matter how much I yell and try to shoo away the wrinkly old couple and the rest of these damn locals, they won't budge. They just keep on crowding around me, yelling in Arabic and pushing their photos into my chest. I'm about to poke one of them with my rifle, hard, when a female voice calls out from the crowd. I speak English. Do you need help? Startled, I look around. An Iraqi girl about my own age separates herself from the mob, walks right up to me, and stares into my face with no fear at all. You really speak English? I ask, amazed. She studies me without answering. Her eyes, which are huge and greenish gold, look suspicious as hell. Yes, she says finally in a low voice. I am able to translate if you like.
I guess I'm wondering to what extent you think gender can be a bridge between two combatant groups, because there are ways in which, being women, they have more in common with each other than they do with some of their compatriots.
Yes, I think that is true. I don't think the bond, the little moment of bonding that happened between the two of them, is that likely to have happened had one of them been a man. Because they're both women, they're not afraid of each other in the way they might be if one of them were a man. There just aren't as many barriers.
The novel doesn't resolve either Naima or Kate's fates. Sort of safe to say nothing is completely wrapped up. What went into your thinking as you made that decision?
Well, Tim O'Brien once said that any war story that ends on a note of hope or ties everything up is a lie. And it's a paraphrase, but I actually really believe that. I wanted to keep true to life. I really believe in not falling into cheap shots or cliches or happy endings just because it's comforting at the end. I didn't really want to be comforting. You know, the war's still going on and people are still suffering, and the consequences of war are lifelong. So there isn't an end, and to have made up one would have been dishonest, is how I feel.
Helen Benedict is the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women in Iraq. Her new novel is called Sand Queen. She spoke with Anne Strange Shapes. Israeli novelist David Grossman joins us next. And later this hour, we'll talk with the anonymous author of a graphic novel inspired by Iran's pro-democracy movement. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
From one of Israel's leading novelists comes a gorgeous and searing story of war and grief. To the End of the Land is David Grossman's acclaimed novel about a mother's fear and trepidation as her son goes to war. Here's an excerpt. It is all a huge, irredeemable mistake. It seems to her that as the moment of separation approaches, the families and the soldiers fill with arid merriment, as if they have all inhaled a drug meant to dull their comprehension. The air bustles with the hum of a school trip or a big family excursion. Men her age, exempt from reserve duty, meet their friends from the army, the fathers of the young soldiers, and exchange laughter and backslaps. We've done our part, two stout men tell each other. Now it's their turn. Television crews descend on families saying goodbye to their loved ones. Aura is thirsty, parched. Half running, she trails behind Ofer. Every time her gaze falls on the face of a soldier, she unwittingly pulls back, afraid she will remember him. Ofer once told her that when they had their pictures taken sometimes before they set off on a military campaign, the guys made sure to keep their heads a certain distance from each other so there'd be room for the red circle that would mark them later in the newspaper. Shortly before he finished his novel, David Grossman's own son was killed while serving in the Israeli army. Partly because of that, the book sparked a national conversation in Israel. When it first came out, Steve Paulson reached David Grossman in Jerusalem.
In the years leading up to The End of the Land, you'd written a lot of journalism and you'd been outspoken in your political views, especially your criticism of the Israeli government, and then you came out with this novel. And I guess I'm wondering what you could do in a novel, in this novel, that you cannot do in your nonfiction writing.
I can give many points of view, not only mine. I can contradict myself. I can write with many more nuances and shades than in a political article. When one writes journalism, he tries to give answers. When one writes fiction, literature, he gives questions.
I'm wondering if part of this has to do with the characters in your novel, especially your central character, Ora, the mother in the story. She seems to have resonated across political lines in Israel, hasn't she?
You know, when the book came out in Israel, people from the extreme right and the extreme left, when they met me or called me, they would say, "You wrote my book." And I thought it's so strange. How come both agree and they are so contradictory to each other? We are so entrenched in our political position. We have no flexibility. And she allows herself, you know, to move very gently, without any problems, from very extreme right positions to very, very extreme left position. And somehow it works because you see that she allows herself to be in full contact with reality around her.
Well, it's so interesting to hear you say that because you are commonly identified as a man on the left in Israel, as a strident critic, particularly of Israeli policy towards Palestinians in the occupied territories. But you're saying that she expresses some views that go beyond your own political views.
Yeah, beyond and contrary to my views. I'm writing literature. I'm not writing here a political pamphlet. And I think that through Ora, I allowed myself to regain some of the nuances of the situation that I have forgotten long ago, I must say. And the main issue of this book is, what does it mean to be a human being in such a conflict? How it changes you, how it narrows you, how it dictates a certain language, and how you can maintain your individuality or regain your individuality after this terrible situation has confiscated your individuality.
Well, it reminds me of a passage that you wrote in one of your essays, in Writing in the Dark, where you say, "I feel the heavy price that I and the people around me pay for this prolonged state of war. Part of this price is a shrinking of our soul's surface area, those parts of us that touch the violent, menacing world outside, and a diminished ability and willingness to empathize at all with other people in pain." And it sounds like you're saying that partly what fiction can do is it creates empathy that really does cut across political lines.
Exactly. This is, for me, the heart of literature. It's the way to understand other human beings from within, you know, to read them from their eyes or within their inner constitution. Now, when I write my stories, I really want to be invaded by the other that I'm writing about. I want that this other will take over me and allow me to see reality through his or her eyes, and it can be an other who is close to me, you know, an Israeli, and he can be a Palestinian, he can be, when I wrote in Sea Under Love, he can be even, you know, a Nazi commander of extermination camp. I want to understand what are the ways to get from me to him and from him to me.
Let me go back to your novel, To the End of the Land. We've been talking about Ora, the mother, whose younger son, Ofer, has just re-enlisted in the army. There's been a call-up by the military. It's the beginning of the Second Intifada, and there's a lot of tension between Ora and her son as he's about to go off to war. Can you describe their relationship?
Yeah, well, like so many mothers and fathers here in Israel, She pampers him until he is 18, and then he is sent to the harsh zone of the occupation, of war. And almost from that moment on, there is growing detachment between the son and the parents. Maybe it is because the parents cannot allow themselves to really know what the son is doing or where he is stationed, in what reality he has to function. They don't want to know it. It's too painful for them. And also the child, the son, I say the child, but they are not children anymore, the son, he has to protect himself from the anxiety of the parents. And he does not want to absorb their doubts, their fears. So there is a kind of estrangement within the house. I remember coming back as a soldier myself when I was 18 or 21, and also when my children came back from the army after serving for a long time. They enter home, they open the door, and they cannot believe their eyes. They cannot believe that such reality exists, that such tender, exposed, almost criminally exposed reality and trust-giving exists. They come, as I said, from war, from brutality, from terrible behavior of settlers and Palestinians in roadblocks, and it's hard for them to absorb it.
Now, Aura is terrified that her son will be killed as he goes off to fight, so she runs away and she adopts a kind of magical thinking, figuring that, if she's not home to hear the news that her son is killed, then the news cannot be delivered and therefore he cannot be killed. Obviously kind of superstitious thinking, but how did you come up with this premise for the story?
It's hard to say how ideas come up, but I must tell you that when you are in such extreme circumstances, this magical thinking is very, very typical. And you cling to everything, every act, every thought that can save your beloved one. But, you know, it's not only an act of escapism, because she does something very active in her escape. She almost kidnaps on her way to the Galilee, to the place where she was meant to hike with her son. She kidnaps Avram. And Avram, who was the love of her youth and the love of her life, he is a broken man. Once he was like a sparkle of light and life and imagination and creativity and sensuality and passion. And then in the war of 73, the Yom Kippur war, he fell captive in the hands of the Egyptians and he came back broken. And he doesn't want any contact with life. But this Avram is the biological father of Ofer. She is not married to him, but he is the father. And she has this idea that if she takes Avram with her, and she will tell him the story life of Ofer, she will tell him all the minutiae, all these small moments when she used to breastfeed Ofer, and the first time he stood up on his feet. All these wonderful domestic moments that we have with children, if she tells it to Avram, if the mother tells it to the father, then the son will be protected even if he's there in the harsh war.
Now, I've heard that when you were writing this novel, you actually took some time out and also went on this long hike north of Jerusalem into the Galilee Hills. Is that right?
Yes, it's right. I walked 500 kilometers in order to understand what it's like, yes, to be alone in nature. And I must tell you, it was the best part of writing this novel.
Was it a little scary as well? I mean, it can be dangerous walking alone in Israel.
Yeah, you know, people warned me all the time before doing it. And I must tell that I never really faced any danger from people, only from animals. I was attacked once by a group of stray dogs, and then I bumped into a couple of wild boars, wild pigs in the Galilee, and of course snakes and scorpions, which are quite frequent in Israel in the spring and in the summer. But besides that, all the people that I met were so hospitable. When you are in the nature, there is something in the generosity of nature that really opens you up.
Now, anyone who is familiar with your own background has heard about the personal tragedy that's become associated with this novel and the fact that your own son, Uri, was killed during the Lebanon War against Hezbollah in 2006. He'd been a tank commander, was just 20 years old when he died.
21 years old.
You had already been working on this book for several years. Was it hard to continue writing after he died?
Of course, it was very hard. But at the same time, you know, writing this book allowed me to be with him again in a different way. He was very involved in the writing process because he was a soldier and he provided me with so many details and practicalities. I used to call him and to ask him questions, and within a minute I got an answer. And each time he came back to his vacation, he was asking me, where am I now in the story? What have I done to the characters of the story? He was a very funny person. Then after this happened, I was not sure I'm able to go back writing the story. I even remember that my friend Amos Oz, the great Israeli writer, he knew what I was writing about before. And when he came to, you know, to the Shiva, Shiva is the Jewish tradition, the 7 days of mourning that we have. And he came and I told him, you know, Amos, I'm not sure I will be able to save the book. And Amos, clever Amos, said the book will save you.
Hmm.
I don't know if he really saved me, but, you know, going back to writing, again finding a place for me in the world, insisting on, you know, the accuracy of words, of metaphors. And it is not a story about death. It's a story about the anxiety, the fear of death that prevails here in Israel to everyone, in everyone, not only in people who lost their beloved ones, but every parent, every Israeli can feel this existential fear. But it's also about vitality, the enormous vitality of life here. Because this is the Israeli being or the Israeli reality, this doubleness, you know, the wholeness of life, the intensity, the high spiritual reality and the high voltage of emotions here, and at the same time a very, very strong subcurrent of fear, existential fear, proximity of death.
David Grossman is one of Israel's most celebrated writers. He spoke with Steve Paulson from Jerusalem about his most recent novel, To the End of the Land. For related stories or to check a title, visit our website at ttbook.org, now featuring a decade of interviews available to stream, download, and podcast. Sometimes the only way to tell the truth is through fiction. In the days after Iran's 2009 elections, thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators took to the streets. The government cracked down, and many of those protesters disappeared, some of them forever. Journalists and human rights advocates who tried to investigate also came under attack, and some also mysteriously vanished. Now, two young writers tell the story in the form of a graphic novel called Zahra's Paradise. For political reasons, the authors use pseudonyms. This is how Amir describes the story.
Zahra's Paradise begins after the demonstrations, and it's the story of a protester named Mehdi who's gone into the streets along with millions of other young Iranians to protest. And as you recall, what sort of moved those protests was the chant of, "Where is my vote?" And he vanishes. He doesn't come back home. And so the story is that of Mehdi's mother, Zahra, who has to basically go right in the immediate aftermath of the protests to the hospitals, and from there to the morgue and the revolutionary courts to see where her son might be. So part of it is a journey through a bureaucracy, a Kafkaesque bureaucracy. And part of it is the story of the resilience of the Iranian people, the resilience of a mother who does not abandon her son. And as you know, of course, in Iran, the women's movement is astonishingly powerful. And so, in a way, it's also a way for us who are outside to honor them.
Is there a little bit that you could read for us from near the beginning to kind of set the stage?
With pleasure. This is the second chapter of Zahra's Paradise. It's called Aftermath. And it begins with Zahra and her son, who's Hassan, who's a blogger, standing outside Evin prison. Many of the families of Iranian prisoners would go and stand outside of Evin prison and chant Allahu Akbar as a way of making sure that people inside know that there are people outside who are witnessing them. So this is where the story begins. Here we are at Evin again, searching for Mehdi. There's no end to the waiting. Finally, a door opens. An insider appears. Big shot. Two bodyguards. Mother approaches him. Sir, sir, one moment, please. Can you help me? My son, Mehdi. Zahra shows him the photograph of Mehdi. Have you seen him? Mr. Bodyguard looks annoyed. Hey, no filming around the prison. Turn that off, now. I've been looking for him everywhere. I haven't heard anything from him for days. He's only 19. He was supposed to take his entrance exams. Nope. You haven't seen him inside? Mehdi Alavi? No, ma'am. Any students his age? Anyone called Mehdi? Sorry, ma'am. I can't help you. He's never been away this long. Never. They say he must be here. I have no one else to turn to. You can help me find him. When did you last see him? At the protests. I think he was marching towards Freedom Square. Freedom Square? June 15th, 2009. 3 million peoples were in the streets. A torrent that could have swept everything in its wake. A few days later, were dismissed as dust and dirt, a scorched riverbed.
It's astonishing how clear it becomes. You can hear. I have in my mind, of course, the image that you presented with the graphic novel of this man who doesn't care. But it's live, and it sounds as though it's quite live for you writing it.
It is, you know, it's been alive for, I think, not just me, but for literally all the Iranian people for the past 30 years at least. And the reason it's live is that, you know, there's life in Evin prison. And as long as that's the case, you know, you just can't let go of what's going on there. When the American hikers were released from Iran's prisons recently after a 2-year stay in Evin prison, it was just gorgeous, you know, seeing them reunited with their families, seeing the American mothers, what they went through and what they did to get their sons back. $1 million was paid by the, you know, Emir of Oman to release them. And as an American, I watch it and it's just thrilling. The other side of me, my Iranian side, watches it. And I was reading what they were saying, and they were talking about the echoes that they would hear in Evin prison, the echo of the screams, the echo of the torture. And you wonder who's left behind, you know. When Nelson Mandela was in Robben Island in prison, and, you know, he's the world's foremost political prisoner, he would say that the most important thing to him while he was in prison was knowing that people outside weren't abandoning him. And not just in terms of saving his life, but in terms of honoring the reasons for which he was in prison. And really, the Nelson Mandelas of Iran are in Evin prison right now. There's a young man, Majid Tavakkoli, a student leader who's in there. Ayatollah Burujerdi, extraordinary religious figure, is in there. A lot of the leading women's rights activists are in there. I mean, how can one let go of the people who are guarding the promise of Iran?
And of course, the worst thing is you don't know whether your loved one is there or not.
Oh, absolutely. That's the other side of it. And thank you very much for bringing it up. There are countless stories of people who suddenly vanish and then their corpse is flung out of a car into a desert. You don't know if your loved one is in Evin prison, in Kahrizak prison. You don't know who has arrested them. You don't know why they've arrested them. I mean, it's an atrocity. It became such an embarrassment. A doctor at Kahrizak named Ramin Puran Danjani what they would do is that prisoners who were killed, you know, they come up with a form and they say everybody's dying there of meningitis. And he refused to sign these forms, a prison doctor. A very, very brave thing. And then he went before parliament to really say what happened to these people. A few days later, he died under very, very dubious and questionable conditions. So they're also, you know, this is now a pattern. This is now a pattern. I mean, Zahra Kazemi, the Canadian photojournalist who was killed in Iran, she was just taking pictures outside Evin prison. pictures of families who were gathering outside Evian prison. She goes in the prison, comes out in a coma, terribly violated in that prison. I mean, broken toes, broken nose, just horrific. Again, this went to the Iranian parliament, under pressure from the Canadian government, under pressure from Penn, journalistic groups everywhere, human rights groups. It became a major case. The guy who was responsible for killing her remains at loose. He's a fellow named Mortazavi. Basically, they just temporarily demoted him and then made him Iran's drug czar. So this is what we're dealing with.
It's overwhelming in a way, but part of what you have done in Zahra's Paradise is to find things that aren't as overwhelming but that still give you hope. One of the parts of the story that I like, I think, is that there are moments of kindness. There are the people who refuse to help, but they're quite ordinary people who do help.
Yeah.
It's clear that Iran still exists, I guess, is what you're saying.
Don't forget, 3 million people poured out into the streets of Iran, did it with dignity, did it with grace, did it with conviction. And that doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, you know, Iran is the land of Hafiz. It's the land of Rumi. It's the land of love. It's the land of life. I mean, that's what it's always been. And those sort of great poets, their teachings are etched in the heart of the Iranian people. I mean, there is a dimension to the Persian language, really, that makes that language a cathedral of love, if you ask me. If we are the heirs, truly, of the Hafizes and the Rumis and the Khayyams that are such a big part of Iran, if we're going to claim their words, you know, we must also claim the bricks of Evin prison as our own. And what's going on behind that as our own. We can't have this split identity between this sort of these two Irans. One of these Irans is going to have to prevail.
Is it hard for you being so far away from it? You left Iran when you were fairly young, is that right?
Yeah, I left when I was 12.
So where did you go to capture the feeling of the place in the here and now and to draw and write its people so intimately?
I kind of was forced to leave Iran fairly quickly. And I think sometimes when you're forced to leave something that you really love, you hold on to it. You hold on to the memories, you hold on to the feelings, the people. And of course, in America, you know, we have millions of Iranians in America. We go back and forth to Iran. We have, you know, relatives and friends all over the place. So the Iranian diaspora is very closely connected to the people in Iran. And a lot of these characters are actually characters that you read about, you know, that emerged in the blogosphere. I mean, they were there, they were alive, they were doing things, they had tremendous agency.
Now, the story as you've written it takes place in 2009, which is before the Arab Spring uprisings. Have those changed? Would it be a different story if you were to tell it now?
You know, when we started this project, it was an Iranian project. And then as we were moving forward, the Arab Spring was coming along. And it was very hard not to miss the connection between what was going on in Iran and what was going on in Tunisia and Egypt and now in Syria. And I've got, you know, I'm sure this will go back to Iran. Because it's clear that all, you know, and beyond Iran and beyond the Arab world, I mean, there's a kind of global spring going on. There's this, everywhere we see the young beginning to assert themselves, from Chile to Greece, you know, even to Wall Street these days. So this sort of tradition of protest that was sort of quiet is once again stirring in the world. And, you know, hopefully one can direct it not towards violence and destruction, but towards community and creation.
You know, I have to ask you why you decided to do this as a graphic novel.
Khalil's the artist, and seeing his talent was what gave me the confidence to move forward with this graphic novel. But the form is actually brilliant, because say when you're making documentary film, which is what I've done before, you have to constantly lug a camera. The sound has to be right. Your timing has to be impeccable. The light has to be right. And it's very expensive. With a graphic novel, really all you need to recreate the streets of Tehran is a pencil. It's the ultimate democratic form, in a sense. We actually wrote this novel this graphic novel in real time, publishing it on the web, and then it would get translated into however many languages, 12 languages or so. So it wasn't just that it was the graphic novel, it was the graphic novel plus internet. And that was just, that was an exhilarating experience.
Amir is the pseudonym of an Iranian-American journalist and human rights activist. He's the author of the graphic novel Zahra's Paradise. The artist, who also chose to remain anonymous, calls himself Khalil. Next, a novel for teens set in Guantanamo Bay. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Imagine being a 15-year-old boy on vacation in Pakistan, kidnapped by armed soldiers and transported thousands of miles away to a place called Guantanamo Bay. It's fiction. Or is it? Ana Pereira is a former teacher and author of an award-winning young adult novel called Guantanamo Boy. The details of the story are fictional, but its most important element is true. There really are teenagers imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. Pereira tells Anne Strainchamps she still remembers the day she learned that.
It was autumn of 2006. Guantanamo had been open since January 2002. And I remember being completely appalled and shocked. It's bad enough that grown men had been abducted and detained and abused without recourse to the law. But to hear that children, juveniles under the age of 18, had also had this experience was too shocking for words. And so the title came to me immediately. I'm a children's writer. I should write a book about this, and I'll call it Guantanamo Boy. It was an immediate reaction.
I think a lot of people don't realize that children have been held at Guantanamo, maybe still are. Who are the children and how many are there?
At the time when I was writing, it was hard to get hold of the exact number, but it was a well-known fact, and there had been reports of children, such as Omar Kader, the young Canadian boy who was picked up at 14. He was still in Guantanamo in 2006 when I heard that, and many others from around the world.
What was it about this story that you thought would be especially powerful or especially appealing to a teenage audience?
Well, in my experience, young people of all ages hunger and thirst for stories which challenge myths that they've been told are the truth. And there seemed to be a myth at that time that torture is something that can be justified. And in my view, it can never be justified. How can you justify harming another human being for whatever reason? So I wanted to hold up a mirror to the insanity of this prison, challenge that myth, and try and ignite a feeling of compassion and healing and peace.
Well, tell me about your main character in this story, Khalid. Who is he and how does he wind up in Guantanamo?
Well, I very carefully picked and thought about who he should be. And he's a 15-year-old boy. He's a second-generation UK citizen. His parents were both immigrants, one from Pakistan, one from Turkey. And he lives the life of any other ordinary British teenager. He likes playing football. He's got a crush on a girl at school. Who wouldn't have at that age? And he enjoys playing computer games with his cousin, Tariq, who he's never met, who lives in Pakistan. And he goes on holiday to Karachi with his family when his grandmother dies. And during that time, his father goes missing. And Khalid goes looking for him. His mother sends him out to an address. And he gets caught up in a demonstration in the street.
And he, later on that evening, he's sitting at home, he's back online on his auntie's computer, talking to his cousin, when men, masked, hooded men, break in and abduct him, throw him into the back of a van and take him to be questioned. But you don't know why he's being picked up. Is it because of his computer game that he plays with his cousin? Is it because of the demonstration? Is it something to do with his father? You don't know. So then you're taken on a journey to Guantanamo. But having said that, there's lots of humour in the book and lightheartedness. It's not just a horrific tale of abuse.
And Khalid, although he sees and experiences dreadful things, he stays a teenage boy through the whole book.
He does. Because certainly from my experience of teaching, I was always aware how resilient teenagers are, how they're able to sort things out in their mind and get on with their lives. Certainly it's something I remember, that you couldn't hold pain for very long. Somehow you'd find yourself laughing about something before long. And so I wanted to use that resilience as a means for him to hold on to reality.
What kind of issues came up for you in writing this as a story for young readers? I mean, you must have had to think about how gritty you wanted it to be, or how you wanted to deal with the possibility of torture.
Yeah, that's a fact. What I didn't do in the first draft, in fact, was have the waterboarding scene. I didn't want to put Khalid through it. I grew too affectionate. But the editor said, you know, we have to have this scene. I remember sitting down writing that. I tried to stay as true to the experience as possible, out of respect for those detainees who'd experienced these awful conditions, sleep deprivation, starvation, extremes of temperature, physical abuse, mental abuse. I knew if I wrote it, I would have to look at all the dark matter there was. Eyes closed, their hands pressing down on his shoulders, Khalid hears the jug being filled with water at high velocity. A cloth lands on his face. More hands hold it down so that he breathes in the smell of gauze, bandages, and at the same time a trickle of cold water pours through the cloth and down to his nose and mouth. At first, Khalid coughs and splutters, gags, sucks the cloth into his nose and mouth, which suffocates him. Struggling, his hands jerk and tremble to get away from the straps, and he tries to vomit, groaning, but the rough hands clamp him down more. A split-second memory of Dad's ghostly face passes through his dying mind as water floods his face. Dad, help me, don't let them kill me. A flicker of breath sits there, just that bit out of reach. His mouth opens to grab it, battle for it, spitting, gurgling the pouring water, but his neck goes rigid with the effort to breathe, with the effort to cough, as lush of water hits his ears. Tell us what you know, the madman shouts.
Wow. Was that the hardest scene to write?
It was a hard scene to write. What I did was sit at the kitchen table with a few pieces of paper, and first I wrote by hand, whereas most of it I wrote straight onto the laptop, and I just sat down and wrote a scene. I knew the elements I wanted to make evident, and they were that this is a child. We're in an inhumane situation. We are going to have to follow him through something I hope that nobody will ever have to experience. And I'm going to have to look at the characters in that scene as if they all are beings with hearts and souls and brains that are able to show compassion, but in this situation have no means to do so.
You're writing as a fiction writer about subjects that have been covered extensively in the news and other places. What do you think the craft or the art of fiction brings to a subject like waterboarding?
Well,
As you say, the subject of Guantanamo is surrounded by millions of newsworthy facts and statistics, and they change from day to day as more stories develop. But the stories that we remember in our heads, to do with our families, to do with our own lives, they stay in our heads because they have a power that facts can never have. They allow us to empathize, and once we know how to empathize, we know how to feel compassion, and that's the power of stories.
Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but I really want to highlight your latest book, also for young adults, and also dealing with a very contemporary conflict. The novel is The Glass Collector, and it's set in a part of Cairo that's probably safe to say very few tourists ever see.
That's a fact. It's set in a place called Makatem, which is a slum area on the outskirts of the city where over 70,000 members of the Zabalin live, and they collect and recycle more than 80% of Cairo's waste. I was sent an article about the Zabalin, and I thought, this is fascinating. I knew nothing about these people. How do they manage to exist in these circumstances? They live, breathe, sleep, and work amongst the most awful conditions. And I thought, I'll have to go out there and see it. So I went out there and hired a translator. And the story came to me because I saw a boy on a cart full of rubbish, and he was in the middle of mad, crazy traffic, and he was in a state of, I can only describe, as supreme bliss. He looked absolutely at peace. And once I saw his face, I knew I could write the story.
So with both these novels, you're telling stories about difficult truths to young audiences. How do you keep your audiences and your books hopeful, or is that important to you?
Yeah, it is important. One of the things that I think it's important to do in the world that we live in is to reflect the world that we live in. But my main ambition is always, always to look at how we are able as a human species to be on this planet and to share what we have and to show that we're capable of amazing things. Magnificent things.
Ana Pereira is a former secondary school teacher. Guantanamo Boy is her first young adult novel. Her second, The Glass Collector, will soon be published in the U.S. Anne Strangechamp spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. If you're looking for book or music listings, you'll find them on our website at ttbook.org. Now featuring 10 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. You can buy a CD copy this hour by calling the radio store. Ask for program number 1016A, Writing War Fiction. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Anne Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Gotcher engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.